Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of Thinking Habits. Again, really, really thank you for the feedback for the first one. I wasn't expecting to get so much feedback from that, and I've had some lovely comments. And thanks again to Jonathan for being involved and being so keen to get on the podcast. It was a really interesting chat, and I'm hoping to have him on again soon. I should prefix today's podcast by saying that there's quite a few content warnings in the subject matter. I'll be talking extensively on suicide. There's some self-harm in there, obviously, and depression and anxiety will filter into that. So if you're affected by any of those things, do please proceed with caution. And I'll be putting some links to organisations and support networks that you can contact should you need to. But it's very important for me that I do this episode early on, because as I said in the intro, I don't feel that I can encourage guests to speak on a podcast openly about mental health issues if I haven't spoken openly about my own first, at least in part. I mean, this is not the sum total of everything, but it's an intrinsic part of why I'm doing this podcast, why I got into mental health nursing, why I am who I am and why I am. So this episode is about intrusive thoughts. It's specifically my experience of intrusive thoughts and a bit of others. No two people's experiences are the same. That's the amazing thing about the brain. The amazing thing about mental health is you can speak to two people with the same diagnosis and they are completely different. So this may resonate with you. This may tick some boxes for you. It may not, but I can only speak to my experience, and I hope it is useful. But I hope you enjoy the episode, and as usual, please do comment and get in touch if you need to. So here we go. Enjoy the episode. This is episode 2, and it's intrusive thoughts. So everybody thinks, we know that, 60,000 to 70,000 thoughts a day for most people, and everybody gets intrusive thoughts. The French call it l'appel du vide, or the call of the void, and that's that sudden urge to jump when you look out of a high window. Almost everyone's had that at least once. But an intrusive thought is an involuntary or unpleasant thought, image or idea that is upsetting or distressing. It can feel difficult to get rid of and may develop into an obsession. Most of the time you can shake them off, they just disappear. People experience them, they go, that was a bit weird, and they move on. Thoughts may, though, become persistent, make you very anxious, and they can, if they extend too far, can become paralysing. They can feel very, very constrictive. Intrusive thoughts, urges and images are almost always of inappropriate things at inappropriate times. Generally, on an aggressive, sexual or blasphemous theme. Recent studies suggest that approximately 40% of themes are actually blasphemous, similar numbers to the more commonly associated themes of contamination that you see with obsessive-compulsive disorder generally. Intrusive thoughts may also be associated with episodic memory, unwanted worries, memories from obsessive-compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress, other anxiety disorders or psychosis. There's also a cultural and societal element to intrusive thoughts. In the 80s and 90s, a very common theme was HIV. Prior to that, it was quite religious themes. A BBC documentary about Royal Bethlehem Hospital featured James and Helen, two extreme OCD patients, two patients with extreme OCD symptoms receiving treatment. James's, if I recall correctly, was to do with his own bowel habits, but there was also an element of the fear of paedophilia, which is incredibly common in in intrusive thoughts, especially with obsessive compulsive disorder, and that lends itself to the societal, the zeitgeist of the thing that is most what they call ego dystonic, because OCD and intrusive thoughts are considered to be ego dystonic or ego alien, as it's called. This means that the intrusive thought and compulsion that a patient experiences or expresses are not consistent with the individual's self-perception, meaning that the patient realizes the obsessions are unreasonable and are often, as a result, distressed by their obsessions, because the patient doesn't understand why something so abhorrent to them is something that they cannot stop thinking about. So a 2007 study found that 78% of a clinical sample of patients with OCD had intrusive thoughts. However, most people who have intrusive thoughts don't necessarily have the classic symptoms of OCD, like washing one's hands. In contrast to obsessive compulsive disorder, you've got obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which is ego syntonic, the opposite of ego dystonic, and generally the patient perceives that obsession with orderliness and perfectionism and control as reasonable and even desirable. This is also seen in narcissistic personality disorders, but we're not really going to be touching on that in this episode. So we're looking at the ego dystonic, the thoughts that run contrary, run against your sense of morals, sense of ethics. People who are clinically depressed may experience intrusive thoughts more intensely and as a result view them as evidence that they are worthless or sinful people. Postpartum depression has a very high, 89% in a 1999 study, a very high correlation with intrusive thoughts about harming or harm coming to the child. That is seen almost everywhere. It's incredibly common, and I know that rings bells with a number of people. The possibility that most patients suffering from intrusive thoughts will ever act on these thoughts, however, is incredibly low, because obviously, again, we're talking about something that is alien to their ethics and their morals. Patients who are experiencing intense guilt, anxiety, shame and upset over these thoughts are different from those who would actually act on them. The suicidal thoughts that are common in depression really must be distinguished from intrusive thoughts, because suicidal thoughts, unlike harmless sexual aggressive or religious thoughts, can be dangerous. And this is where my problems began to overlap. So I was diagnosed with depression and obsessive compulsive disorder stroke general anxiety when I was 23, after a pretty spectacular meltdown. Prior to that, I had no idea what was wrong, except that I was absolutely certain that I was losing my mind. My earliest recollection of this thinking pattern is an incident from my childhood that is honestly as vivid as if it happened half an hour ago. I was about 11, and we were watching a Channel 4 programme one Sunday night. And there was a programme on the TV about mental illness, in particular, schizophrenia. I think it was something to do with like care in the community or something, but it was about schizophrenia. And I asked my dad what schizophrenia was. And he explained briefly what it was, but he explained that his dad had it. My granddad. So we carried on watching the programme. And later on in the programme, I learnt that current research suggested that schizophrenia was hereditary. So then I asked my dad what hereditary meant. And I can remember exactly where I was, sat in the living room, sort of like crouched down on the floor, and I was engulfed with a fear the like of which I have not felt since, and I recall it absolutely clear. I didn't sleep that night or the next night. As far as I was concerned, it was possible that I would end up mentally ill. Therefore, I would. It was a foregone conclusion, no question. It was done. The lid had come down on my coffin as far as I was concerned. This is 11 years old. I didn't know any better. I didn't know what to do. I stopped eating. I completely retreated into my room. And over time, I developed certain rituals to keep this crushing sense of foreboding, but at the same time, inevitability at bay. Because I didn't know what to do with these feelings. So at all hours of the night, when it got really bad, when I was about sort of 12 or 13, I would rearrange my bedroom. And I mean all of it, not just organising your DVDs or or books into alphabetical order. I mean, furniture, books, clothes, everything. Everything would come out in the middle and I'd have to rearrange it. And I could not sleep until it was exactly right, because otherwise I was going to end up mentally ill. And this was my kind of tidy house, tidy mind thing, but taken to an extrapolated level. I'd do that every week or two, otherwise I couldn't function. I was on my own on the top floor of it was quite an old house. I had the top floor to myself, so I became an expert at making these changes with minimal fuss so as not to wake my mum. I didn't understand why I was doing it, but I resigned myself to the fact that this was how it had to be. So my intrusive thoughts as a child were primarily around mental illness. There was a brief period when that subsided, and there was another quite common thought pattern in obsessive compulsive disorder is about sexuality, especially in young adolescence. I went through that as well. And death. I thought about death a lot. I only understood the connection between these obsessions and compulsions years later, but at the time, tidy house, tidy mind was kind of like, I mean, it's a very simplified way of saying it, but it was kind of like my mantra. However, over the following months, it faded into the background noise of other worries. Never truly gone, but less intrusive. It was almost as if I'd kind of reached a sort of peace with it. Looking back on that now, I was just going, into an acute remission phase, really. Half a dozen such episodes throughout my teens and early 20s, and I realised that I needed to get some help. I was finding excuses to leave work to check doors. I was cancelling nights out and family visits because the flat wasn't just so. I was labouring endlessly on the minutiae of every single conversation or action I performed. I was second-guessing everything and everybody, and I couldn't function. I felt like I was getting more and more trapped. And then I stumbled on a book on a website. I googled my symptoms, or I was probably asked Jeeves then or something like that, but because it was a while ago. But it's a book by a doctor called Ian Osborne, and it's called Tormenting Thoughts and Secret Rituals. Now, he's a surgeon in America, and I remember him reading about him having intrusive thoughts while he was performing surgery, which is nothing like the ones I was getting. But I chanced upon it via the internet search, which led me to Amazon. In fact, I think it was the first book I ever bought from them, and I picked up this book and read his story about his surgery. And he ended up speaking to other patients who have the same issues. And I use a cliche, but to say that I read my life before me on the page, and that really underestimates the sense of relief that I felt when I realised that other people felt like this as well. It gave me the courage to go to the GP and say, I'm experiencing these symptoms. I have intrusive, obsessive thoughts. I have compulsions to try and keep them at bay. I think I need some help. So my GP was great. He kind of went, yep, okay. Yep, we'll start that. So I was referred for counselling, which was terrifying at first. Nobody had ever heard this stuff out loud. I'd never told anybody, not even my partner at the time. This was all in my head, and it had been since I was 11 years old. This was entirely my own issue, and unleashing my fears on an unsuspecting stranger convinced me that he would consider me as untreatably bonkers, because I'd never even voiced this before. Obviously he didn't. Just like the book suggested, my fears and behaviours were normal for somebody with depression, anxiety, OCD, and over the next 6 weeks I was given some CBT exercises, which did have a positive effect alongside the meds. I was started on fluoxetine, Prozac, at 23. But looking back now, with the benefit of 18 years of hindsight, I barely scratched the surface. I talked about the things that I felt were important at the time. And it helped me to generate coping mechanisms for the intrusive thoughts that I was getting, and the compulsions that were stopping me from functioning properly. But I don't think I got to the root of it then at all. So 10 years later, I find myself a qualified mental health nurse, and the irony isn't really lost on me that I look back at that terrified boy in his immaculate bedroom and I kind of understand where my fascination with mental health started, yeah, and it does feel a little bit like ongoing exposure therapy for me. I really just needed to know why, and I think that comes from the anxiety part of my brain. I have to know why. What if a conversation doesn't go the way I expect it to go? I can't just let it go. Why? I have to pick it apart. So it stands to reason to me that if I'm having a problem with my mental health, I need to know why. And it sent me down this rabbit hole, and I find myself a qualified mental health nurse. I'm fascinated by how the mind plays tricks on you. It warps reality, and I really want to know how we can understand it better. And that's where I found myself. So I still get echoes of those childhood intrusive thoughts. They don't really bother me. It's like I speak a lot in metaphor. It helps me to articulate things, and people who know me will know that I do that. But what this feels like to me now is it's like a piece of paper with the dents of the writing from the page that was on top of it. So they're still there, and I know that they're there, but those particular thought patterns of becoming mentally ill, the intrusive thoughts about my own sexuality that I had when I was sort of 11, 12, 13, they don't really bother me at all. They're there, but they're of no real consequence now. More recently, though, my intrusive thoughts took on a far more alarming and stark form, which caused me some real problems. As I said in the intro episode, I think it was, it might have been in episode one, I was working, my first job post-qualifying was in the drug service in Manchester Prison. I was there in the drug service for 2 years, and then I moved into the mental health inreach team. I loved that job. I was good at it. I really got on well with the patients. I felt like I was doing really good work in an incredibly stressful situation. What I realise now is that the job did not like me. It's not what I should have been doing. I did not have the emotional resilience to deal with that long term. Combine that with a shockingly poor support network from the trust that I worked for. Their clinical supervision was non-existent. You were left, because you were behind four walls, you were left to fester. And then when something went wrong, you were thrown under the bus. And I say that with the knowledge that not a single person, bar one, in our team of nine within the mental health inreach team escaped without some kind of mental health problem or an exacerbation of existing symptoms, because the pressure and the stress and the lack of support was like a salt. It just grew on you and grew on you and grew on you until you collapsed. And after an incredibly stressful case and a subsequent coroner's inquest, I was signed off with depression and stress. This was in 2012. I went to counselling and spoke about, again, like I did when I was 23, what I thought was the problem. I felt better, got myself on some more meds, went back to work. Because at this point, I'd stopped taking my Prozac because I thought I was well. And then when I was getting unwell, I'd been off Prozac for so long, I didn't start it again. And so when I restarted it, obviously, my serotonin started to recalibrate itself and I started feeling better. So I thought, right, okay, crack on, let's go back in. So I went back in. But in 2013, I started getting very loud, detailed, intrusive thoughts about suicide. Not just the stereotype call of the void stuff, driving off a bridge on the way home, jumping off high places. These were bloody, visceral, intense thoughts of ending my life. There was plans, there were equipment, I had locations, and I could not stop these thoughts from entering into my head. And these weren't daydreams about, you know, going down a path. These were fully formed, visceral images of my own death. It was the first thought I had when I woke up. It was the last thought I had before I went to sleep, if I got any sleep at all. I didn't want to. I knew it for what it was. I knew they were intrusive thoughts, but it came at a time when my coping skills were not up to scratch. Working in that Cat A prison with some incredibly challenging patients was taking every ounce of my emotional strength, and I left none for my own self-care. And again, the support that we had was so poor. So I became depressed, I became incredibly anxious, and the noise just got louder and louder and louder. So my check-in rituals got worse again. My ordering, I was anxious, I was snapping at Pam, my wife, just because things weren't just so. Because if things were just so, if I was focused and pinpoint accurate on everything I could control, then I could keep these thoughts at bay. But it just got louder and louder and louder and louder. And these intrusive thoughts went from being an irritant to an exit. It got so bad where I was performing my work by rote. I was sitting in front of patients and they were telling me about their thoughts of suicide, their anxiety, their depression. And they were talking about, have you got any plans? And they'd tell me, and I would give them the advice that I'd trotted out hundreds of times before. But in my head, while I was writing all this down, I was thinking, well, I'm not going to do it that way because I'm going to do it like this. And that's when I realised that they weren't intrusive thoughts anymore. They were becoming suicidal ideation. And I was very close to breaking point at that point. In my time as a practicing RMN, I was surrounded by support networks, therapies, nurses, psychologists, pamphlets. I have a wealth of information to draw on, which can point people in the right direction. And I was very lucky that my colleagues spotted me in time and made me get help. I don't really remember being sent home. I remember being in a meeting, talking, and then I remember being taken out of the meeting halfway through, and I just remember breaking down in the office and then being sent home. And that's it. That's all I remember, really, for 2 or 3 days. But this time, it was different. When I went to the doctors this time, I knew I had to approach things differently. This was not the same as it was last time. This was serious. I came very, very close to killing myself. So I knew that I couldn't cherry pick the problems. It was all or nothing. I was referred for counselling again. Credit where it's due. Occupational health for the trust, superb. That I cannot fault my counsellor for anything once you get it, but my issue with the support network is you shouldn't have to reach breaking point before help is offered. This is with the benefit of 4 or 5 years of hindsight, but there we are. So I met this counsellor, Chris, and I saw him. I remember seeing him in the corridor and I thought, oh mate, me and you aren't going to get on. We're not at all. His belt was up to his ribs. He had a mobile phone pouch on his belt with like a Nokia 3210 in it. And I was thinking, oh God, you're not going to know me. You're not going to understand me. But I thought, fuck it, I'm here now. I've got to do this. It's either going to work or it isn't. So I sat down in front of this guy and I just blurted it all out, everything. I mean, stuff from when I was 11, stuff right the way through, the whole lot just fell out of my mouth. And I couldn't, once I started, I just could not stop. It just, it was just like vomit. And I left that first counselling session absolutely empty. I was a shell. There was nothing left to say. It was the first time in my life I told anybody what my brain was saying to me. And I slept for the rest of the day. I slept right the way through to the next morning. I had 12 counselling sessions and it absolutely changed my life. CBT worked for a little while, but because I'm so who, what, why, how about everything, I felt like I was deconstructing CBT. And because I could deliver it, I kind of saw both sides. So it didn't, I felt like I was building a Lego car with, I already knew the instructions, so I felt like I was doing it by rote. It didn't feel like it was challenging me or my thoughts or my rituals or anything like that. So this kind of person-centered dialectical counselling, this was different. I'd never had that before. And this guy just sat in my brain and went, just poked just at the right point. What about that? What about that? Why did you say that? not putting any ideas in my mouth, not, you know, but giving me the opportunity to really look at things from different angles. And I exorcised a lot of demons in those 12 weeks, demons that I've carried since before I knew what a demon was. And I came out of there, I mean, don't get me wrong, I was on a shitload of new meds, but I came out of there and I went back to work and I said, right, I am going back to work because I want to go back to work because I am ready. And I went in there like a fucking soldier and I was just like, right, I am on a mission. I am going to do this. And when I leave this place, I will leave on my own two feet and I will leave with my head held high. I know I can't do this forever, but I'm going back in to prove that I am a good mental health nurse. And I knew I could do it. So I went back in and it worked. It was wonderful. I went back in and the support that I got from most of my colleagues was incredible, absolutely incredible, because a lot of them had been there. A lot of mental health nurses have first or second hand experience of mental health problems. They know what it's like. Not everybody was supportive, but you know, it doesn't matter whether you work in Tesco or Strangeways. Some people are dicks, and you're never going to get on with everybody. But that's fine. That's fine. But a year later, I'd always said to Pam, if I ever sound like a prison officer as opposed to a mental health nurse when I'm talking about patients, I need to stop nursing. And I didn't get that far, but the management structure above our team was making it almost impossible for us to work with patients as patients. And you combine that with the government cuts that retired experienced prison officers early, locked prisoners up for longer, replaced those prison officers with basically minimum wage, the prison officer equivalent of a healthcare assistant, but with keys. You've got an angry prison population who don't get access to their basic rights, and a prison staff who are paid minimum wage. They don't want to get involved with somebody's mental health. And you know, I don't blame them for that. But from my point of view, we've got 2 hours in the morning, 4 hours in the afternoon to work with a patient, and we can't get them unlocked. And if we can't get them unlocked, I'm not doing a private one-to-one mental health assessment with a patient through the door. So I said to him, I've had enough. I'm not nursing anymore. I'm a paper pusher for the prison service, and I don't feel like I'm nursing anymore. So I decided I could either go out and be an agency nurse, or I could leave nursing, frontline nursing, for a little while. So I decided to do that, and I was lucky that I dropped on with a job going back into IT, but still doing clinical stuff. So I still get to keep my registration active, because that's something I really want to do, and I've been able to work on my continual professional development by doing that. But I know that with hindsight, I should never have been working in the prison as much as I loved it. But here I am, and it's made me the person I am today, and I'm sat here talking about it in a candid manner that I never thought I'd be able to do. Every now and again, I take my eye off the ball. You know, I'm not infallible, and I don't do my own housework. And I suppose it's good for me, in a way, to understand how easy it is to let things get on top of you. It gives me an empathy with others and a better understanding of their issues. However, it's also really important for me to apply the same solutions that I advise. And this is the bit that I forget. I still analyse everything, including what I say, how I say it, and most crucially, the reaction from others. If this reaction isn't precisely as I expected, I need to know why. It's that whole how, what, why thing again, because the assumption is that I've offended somebody in some way. And starting from this viewpoint means that I'm immediately on edge. So I can come across as quite confident, but behind the scenes, I am cataloguing every single thing I've said to make sure that I haven't done something wrong. And this is the daily aspect of the anxiety side of my presentation. exacerbated by my propensity to obsess over things. It never goes away completely. You have to manage that. It's that whole riding the wave analogy. You know, it gets better or worse. There's loads of different things that make it worse. And that's called catastrophizing or catastrophic thinking. I used to use the phrase regularly when I was typing up assessments or working in one-to-one sessions. I could explain calmly the ways around the issues and help people to rationalize the issue to take their fear away. Then I'd go home and worry myself upside down over the fact that there were certain bills due, or I'd had a text message that had been misinterpreted, or, you know, these are just little examples, but you get the idea. There's plenty of room in your own head to rake over the minutiae of everything, extrapolating the worst case scenario and settling on that. And it ends up being the cruel inevitability that that is the way it's going to go, whereas most of the time it isn't. And again, I talk a lot in metaphor because it helps me articulate how my thoughts manifest. But for me, catastrophizing is like playing one of those choose your own adventure books that were so popular when I was young, like Warlock of Firetop Mountain and oh God, what was that other one? It was something assassin. It was brilliant. It was number 20 anyway. My absolute favourite. But you're not entirely sure what's going to happen when you turn to page 97. But in my book, the book in my head is always the worst case scenario. Always. And I'm always on point for that one. I can't... Living in the present moment is... Mindfulness has taken a lot of work. And I'm better than I was. But I still go there. In reality, if it's bad, you keep your finger in the current page of the Choose Your Own Adventure book and pretend you meant to go the other way anyway. That way, you don't die. In a way, this is what therapy and medication and mindfulness do for me. Rather than remorselessly obsessing over the monster in the labyrinth or, you know, whatever the thing is, I get a torch to see the map on the wall. So I get a little bit more breathing space. I get a little bit more... time to be rational about these anxieties. I can deal with it far better now. I tend to treat it like I used to treat a craving for cigarettes. If it passes if I distract myself from stuff. The problem arises when I get faced with a worry that doesn't have an identifiable and quantifiable result. Everyday situations like bills, you know, that kind of thing, that far less of a problem now. But out of the ordinary situations become really complex scenarios and that require really careful dissection, with the inevitable conclusion that the worst case scenario is the only possible outcome. And that can go from 0 to 100 miles an hour in a matter of seconds. And the problem is, once you hit that road, then adrenaline kicks in. And even though scientifically, you know, we could talk about the fact that adrenaline and cortisol and that reaction only lasts 20 minutes, that's fine. But if you're already have a predisposition to obsess over things, 20 minutes is more than enough time for that little itch to be scratched, and you start going down a little rabbit hole which takes a lot longer to get out of. But meditation, counselling, other coping mechanisms have meant that it seldom gets too bad now. I'm occasionally not giving it the respect it deserves and it kicks me in the ribs. It's worse when I'm tired or stressed, which is a vicious circle in itself. Perhaps worse is that a couple of times in the past, I've talked about already, I stopped taking my meds because I was feeling well. And at the same time, when I was at work, I would be talking to a client about the rebound effects of doing so, about rebound effects of stopping taking your meds. I could see that they were objectively better, but they lacked the insight or coping skills to deal with the crisis. Medication helps, but recovery and maintenance requires investment. So, treatment-wise, a while ago, I realised that I need good sleep. I need my eight hours. A bit less caffeine, which is a bit harder for me because I love coffee. Sunshine and exercise. And a lot of people talk about that, and it sometimes sounds cliched, but it does help. But I'm also very aware that I am blessed with a brain that does not regulate serotonin properly. I am perfectly comfortable taking medication. I see it no different to somebody with diabetes taking insulin. My brain doesn't do what it's supposed to do, and an an SSRI like sertraline, which is what I'm on now, helps me to do that. It's not the be all and end all. I have to be, it's a two-way street. I have to be invested in this process. I have to work on this. I have to do things to keep things going. But sertraline unlocks the door. I'm the one that has to go through that, and I know that. I started doing mixed martial arts recently. I'm shit at it, but I found it really, really positive as a stress release and as an emotional regulator. You have to remain calm in situations that are frenetic, fast, violent, and you have to keep your wits about you, but you have to be in the present moment. You can't be anywhere else because you're going to get punched in the face, and that really helps me. I find that quite mindful in a sort of abstract way. Another thing that I find incredibly mindful is that I do origami. I've done origami for years, since I was about 7 years old, and I use that as a mindfulness exercise because you have to be precise. If you make a mistake at the beginning, it is manifestly larger at the end. The model doesn't turn out the way you start, the way you finish it, if you don't start it right. So you have to be specific. So for me, I've got a suite of coping exercises. I've got a set of coping mechanisms. Other treatments for intrusive thoughts include things like exposure therapy, directly facing a feared object, vividly imagining the feared object with guidance, with counselling. You can use virtual reality nowadays. You can use graded exposure, or what they call flooding, where you are presented with no escape from the thing that is upsetting you. CBT, again, didn't really work for me, but I know many, many, many people who it has changed incredibly. Based on the concept that your thoughts, feelings and physical sensations and actions are interconnected, and the negative thoughts and feelings can trap you in a vicious cycle. It aims to help you deal with those overwhelming problems in a more positive way by breaking them down into smaller parts. The problem for me was that I was breaking them down still further, and then they were becoming useless to me. But again, I don't knock it because I know it works. Medication. Antidepressants and antipsychotic medications have been used for more severe cases of intrusive thoughts that don't respond to CBT or exposure therapy alone. This particular quote came from Mind, I think. But I don't strictly agree with that. I think if you're experiencing intrusive thoughts that are affecting your quality of life, you should be... The best results come from starting both at the same time, meds and CBT, and then you withdraw one and then hopefully the other. Whether the cause of intrusive thoughts is OCD, depression or PTSD, SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, are most commonly prescribed. What that means is that sometimes serotonin either isn't produced in enough quantity or it's absorbed too quickly for the brain to use it properly. So if you consider serotonin as your brain's filing system, if serotonin isn't around in your brain long enough, the files aren't put away. So they sit in your brain and they bounce around. What an SSRI does is it leaves the serotonin in there for longer. It slows down the reabsorption of the serotonin, so you have time to file those thoughts away. A retrospective chart review of patients with symptoms that were treated with SSRI showed the greatest improvement was in those with intrusive sexual obsessions and also blasphemous obsessions typical of OCD. There are loads of studies that have shown that SSRIs do help with obsessive thoughts. Women with postpartum depression do often have anxiety as well and may need lower starting doses of SSRIs. They may not respond fully to the medication, and CBT or response prevention therapy may help. But that's the same for anybody with intrusive thoughts and OCD. But like I said, I've got my own suite. What works for me may not work for you, It may work for other people. You may cherry pick what works for you and you may dismiss others. There is no one true way, just like there's no two same brains. But what I've taken from all this is that I'm still learning to worry less about what other people think of me and focus more on what I think of me. I speak openly about all this stuff, and I still carry with me the fear that I'm alone, I'm unique in my thoughts, and I'm a mystery to normal people. But then I listen to what other people have to say, and it reminds me that I'm not. And this is all splendid advice, which I'd still occasionally studiously ignore when it comes to my own issues. I concluded a few years ago that I am a good mental health nurse, but working in a prison was not right for me. So I left on my own terms with a sense of sadness, but also a sense of accomplishment. But I need to practice what I preach. I don't profess to be an expert. This is not intended to be a scholarly article. And I would advise anybody who is experiencing any symptoms that resonate with this podcast to speak to a doctor or a health professional if you are struggling with your mental health. I'll be sharing links on the social media pages. There is help out there. There is good help, good support. The NHS mental health provision has come under fire, and rightly so recently, because the length of time it's taking to refer people for counselling and support for a variety of different mental health issues is not good enough. The government have absolutely destroyed mental health provision in this country. However, that doesn't mean that there is not help available, and that doesn't mean that there aren't good, hard-working, dedicated, empathetic mental health nurses, doctors, psychiatrists, counsellors out there who are ready and willing to help you. It's just a matter of finding the one that works for you. So I hope that this podcast has been useful. It's a bit longer than I expected it to be. But as I said, this is something that's very important to me, that I share where I come from, because it sets the benchmark for where I intend to go with this. And for you to understand the way I see the world, or I have seen the world, makes it easier for me to articulate other things in future. But also, it means that, you know, there could well be the odd disco freak out in a few months' time. You'll understand why. I'm not going to keep any of that a secret. If it happens, touch wood, it won't. But, you know, if I can't talk about it, then why should I expect anyone else to? So, I'll be sharing a load of links to support networks, not just in the Manchester area, but nationally as well. And I think that pretty much wraps it up. One thing I will say, actually, is I wanted to add this on. A friend of ours, it was on the BBC News, and well, it went, I think it went worldwide, actually. You may have seen on the news last week, there was a lady who was stranded in the desert in California for 4 days after slipping on a rock and shattering her pelvis. She survived. I have no idea. The strength and the fortitude of Claire in this situation absolutely beggars belief. But she is currently in the US. She's had a number of operations, I think. She had at least one to reconstruct her pelvis. She's learning to walk again. She has full travel insurance, obviously, but her bills are still going to be pretty hefty. So there is a Just Giving page which has been set up for Claire to help cover some of those medical expenses while she begins the long and incredible road to recovery. And I bring this up not only because I know Claire, and I've written a couple of blog posts for her old website a few years ago, but also because if anything requires mental health, mental strength, mental fortitude, and the support of peers, friends, and family. It's something like this, and I can't think of anything more worthy of a network of people who are looking to improve their mental well-being than reaching out and supporting other people who are struggling in times of crisis. We send all our love to Claire as she recovers, and I will be putting the Just Giving link on the webpage. Hopefully she'll be up and about, and who knows, maybe she might come on the podcast in a couple of years when she feels up to it. But anyway, that's it for me today. I think 45 minutes is more than enough that you need to hear from me. So I will see you for episode 3. What I will say as well is that I'm hoping to release them every Sunday. It really depends on my work schedule. If I can get the interviews scheduled in enough time and get them edited, I will do that. If not, it might occasionally switch to every other Sunday, or I might put them out midweek. But Sunday's the day that I aim to do it, because that's the day when I can sort of aggregate all my free time together and get it all sorted. So if I am going to delay it, I will let everybody know, but please bear with me. In the meantime, you can get hold of me at podcast@thinkinghabits.co.uk. All the socials are set up. There's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I've also got the website set up. It's pretty basic at the minute, but I'll be adding things to that as and when. And finally, there's a little link at the bottom. If you feel that I deserve it, or you feel like you've enjoyed what you hear and you want to hear more, you can buy me a coffee. As I've discussed, I quite like coffee, and for the price of a cup of coffee, it helps me to keep everything running, and it keeps it will help me to be able to sort of manage doing this alongside all my other commitments. Don't feel obliged to, but if you do feel like you would like to, I'd very much appreciate it. So in the meantime, keep talking, and if you need to talk, you know where I am. Bye.